Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Good morning, Norwalk. We have an educational session this afternoon, and we're going to talk about a couple of papers on classification and measurement. I give the floor to Rihanna.
Thank you. The focus of this joint education session is on the business model assessment in IFRS 9 and the FASB's proposed accounting standards update. And during the session, we will not discuss the contractual cash flow characteristics condition. And for the purpose of these agenda papers, we've assumed that the financial assets have satisfied the contractual cash flow characteristics. In terms of the running order, we will introduce and discuss the agenda papers in the following order. I will start with agenda paper 6A, that's the memo 249, which discusses the overall business model assessment. Then Nick will introduce agenda paper 6B, FASB memo 250, which discusses the hold-to-collect business model. And finally, Raul will present agenda paper 6C, or FASB memo 251, which talks about fair value for the company's income and fair value through profit and loss. Now, this is an education session only, as I've said, and we will not be asking the board to make any decisions at this session. We expect to ask for decisions on the business model assessment at the November joint meeting. So with that, I'll start on agenda paper 6A. Now, this is the first paper in the series of papers on the business model assessment in IFRS 9 and the FASB's proposed ASU. And the paper focuses on the business model assessment generally. All the topics discussed in this paper are relevant to all of the measurement categories in the board's classification and measurement models for financial assets. This agenda paper provides relevant background information, which includes a summary of the business model guidance and the feedback the board received on their respective exposure drafts. It then goes on to discuss the clarifications to the requirements and provide a summary of the staff recommendations. Now, from a staff perspective, we want to emphasize that the recommendations made in this agenda paper are clarifications only, and we are not recommending any fundamental changes to the business model assessment. Both IFRS 9 and the FASB's proposed ASU require financial assets to be classified on the basis of the business model within which those financial assets are managed. They also include additional application guidance on the business model assessment and the evidence that is relevant to assessing the business model. And this includes how the performance of the business is reported, how the managers of the business are compensated, and the frequency, timing, and volume of sales in prior periods. Using these considerations, financial assets are subsequently measured at amortized cost, fair value through other comprehensive income, or fair value through profit and loss. And the other two agenda papers we'll discuss today discusses the requirements for the business models of these measurement bases in more detail. The IFRS 9 and the FASB's proposed ASU also include requirements around reclassifications and when financial assets should be reclassified when the business model for the assets changes. Although the majority of the respondents supported classification based on the business model assessment, some requested clarifications of the application guidance. The staff analysis on these matters are provided in paragraphs 33 to 66 of the paper, and the summary of the staff recommendations on these matters are provided in paragraph 67 to 73. Now, in terms of the meaning of the term business model, we are recommending that the application guidance be clarified to state that the business model refers to the management of financial assets in order to generate cash flows or create value for the entity. So, for example, will the entity generate cash flows by collecting the contractual cash flows or through collecting the contractual cash flows and selling or something else? The business model should therefore allocate financial assets to the measurement basis that will provide the most relevant and useful information about the activities and the risks or how the activities on the risk for those financial assets are managed. We do not recommend that the board mandate the level at which the business model should be assessed, but that the application guidance should be improved to clarify that that level should reflect financial assets managed together to achieve a particular objective, and that assessment should therefore be undertaken in a way that enables the entity to describe how its business is managed and to tell the story of how it's managing its business. On the question of what information should be considered in making the assessment, we recommend to clarify that the business model is often observable through particular activities that are undertaken to achieve the objectives of that business model. These activities usually reflect the way in which the performance of the business model and the underlying financial assets in that business model are evaluated and reported, as well as the risks that are typically impact the performance of that business model. An entity should therefore consider all relevant and objective information that is available at the date of making that assessment, but should not consider every what-if or worst-case scenario that the entity does not reasonably expect to occur. As discussed in the feedback session, respondents questioned the role of sales in making the business model assessment. We therefore recommend to clarify that information about sales activity should not be considered in isolation, but in conjunction with other information as part of a holistic assessment of how financial assets are managed. Historic sales information and patterns could provide useful information, but should not be considered in isolation and is therefore not determinative. So if cash flows are realized in a way that is different from the entity's expectations at the date that the assessment is made, it will neither result in the restatement of prior period financial statements, nor a change in the classification of the remaining assets in that business model, but it could have an impact on the classification of future financial assets within that business model. Then finally, with regards to the concerns about when there will be a change in the business model, we recommend to clarify that the change in business model will occur only when an entity has either stopped or started doing something on a level that is significant to its operations. And that will generally be the case when an entity has acquired or disposed of a business line. And with that, I'll ask whether the board has any questions or comments on the staff recommendations and the analysis in the agenda paper.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is the right moment, but I can try. Have you learned anything about the practice around this? I can imagine that I have a portfolio of bonds or something, and I hold them to collect. But I like to take advantage of the upside. If there's a drop in interest rate, or I have a chance of taking a profit. I would imagine that for me, the most important information would then not to have the net of some bonds with losses and some with profits. Perhaps the net is zero, but I have a very nice upside on some of these bonds. And therefore, the information value for me would partially be hidden by the netting of the losses and profits. The second question, if I then realize the profit, am I allowed to reinvest? Assume that there's been a drop in the interest rate, I take a profit, and I invest in similar bonds after, the day after, 2 days after. And thereby I just realize my profit earlier, and then I take a lower return later on. Would that be a problem?
Which business model? Goal to collect for amortized cost?
Well, for the fair value OCI.
I think we will get into the details of each of those business models when we go through the paper.
Okay.
But to get back to the first part of your question, whether we've learned anything from experience or from the industry, we have. And when we did our informal outreach to the entities to find out how they've applied the business model assessment that we have currently and how they would go about defining what that business model is. They've pointed out that they look at the activities that they are doing, and with each business model there are certain activities that you associate with that business model, and that is driven by the risks and the information you get from the business model. So we were using what we've been told through them and through the comment letters in making our recommendations in this paper. So we've tried to learn from them, from practice.
And they consider the information of having the net gains and losses to be of value?
No, I think if in a business model like you described, where you only focus on the upside, I think the upside is going to be the performance indicator is going to be. So you'll focus more on the upside and not necessarily on the net when you assess the performance, but when you report it and you decide to fair value OCI as your business model, you would then have to take the net.
Sorry, I cannot follow this. You focus on the upside.
Well, if you have a portfolio of bonds, assume that some of them are with a premium. So you can sell them tomorrow,
yeah,
and you can take a gain.
Yeah.
You say my basic thinking is if I have amortized cost, there's sort of a floor,
yeah,
and if it goes down, I just leave it there. If it goes up,
so the value is increasing,
I take the profit.
Yeah.
So this quarter I need some profits, I take the profits, bring them into my profit and loss statement, and then I rebuy the same bond 2 days later, but with a lower yield.
If you've got a model where you're going to sell and reinvest, our analysis focuses on whether cash flows are coming in from crystallizing sales proceeds or contractual cash flows. That's the basic idea. So even if you were to sell and to reinvest, we would think of that selling activity as being relevant. So it would be one of the things you'd think about in making the assessment about whether or not amortized cost information would be good information, or whether you also need to start having fair value through OCI type information all the way to fair value through P&L. So the fact that you reinvest, I don't think would change the way that we would handle those statistics.
And what was this talk about the net?
Yeah, when we were talking about the business model, I don't think we will still record this asset by asset and liability, asset by asset. We are not thinking within a business model, if you have gains and losses, you can get it down to a single number. So you would get the total information that is there.
Thank you, I trust you. If you have a portfolio with some bonds with profits and some with losses,
yeah.
What the business model test is doing, or is trying to achieve, is put you in the category whether you will measure these at amortized cost or fair value through OCI or fair value through P&L. That's all we are trying to do. We are not saying that we will net the down.
Doug?
Yes, thank you. Let me test whether we still have a painting rule or not. I think you are trying to delete painting rule. However, in your paragraph 57, if in the case sales are different from the business model or expectation, it may affect future judgment. So substantially, it is, in a sense, part of the tainting rule. And the reason why I'm confused was, you have this paragraph 57, which is very good. However, on the other hand, when you assess the business model change, the business model change must be very infrequent, and that should be limited to acquisition of new business line or disposal of business line. But this rule and paragraph 57 is, in a sense, inconsistent, because you have a business model and which is amortized cost, and then you sell more than expected. And then you say it would affect the future judgment. And if you only have a business model of amortized cost, then do you have to acquire new lines, or do you have to make different lines? So it's a little bit confusing and difficult to understand. So I just would like to how you explain those two different requirements.
To answer your first question about whether we are in a manic painting, there's never been any painting notion in our first time. So we never had it, we never wanted to have it, and I think even in the basis for conclusions, the board has concluded why painting is no longer relevant. So when we say that if you have a lot of sales and it won't affect what you're doing with your existing assets, but it may affect the classification of future assets, that is not in, it's not the painting notion we have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just saying you need to consider all relevant information to classify that. And you're right that we are saying changes in business model is expected very infrequent. As we've said, the changes in business model is only when you stop doing something or you start doing something that is the potential operation. We're not saying it is limited only to disposal to acquisition. It could be if you have changed in your business model where you've decided, you know, big part of your assets, mortgages, whatever, you're going to manage differently, you're now going to hold for sale.
Mm.
But we just said typically it is so big, it is something that is so big to the entity, it's typically when you have an acquisition or a disposal. So it's not limited to that.
And also a change in business model is where you actually change the classification of existing financial assets, whereas if you start to have differences in selling activity, that would affect
Martin?
Yeah, question on paragraph 48. And we say under B that those activities usually reflect the way in which the performance of the business model and underlying financial assets in that business model are evaluated and reported. I think for that you mean internally performance measures. But then it goes further and then as well as a risk that typically impacts the performance of the business model. I think it is not dependent on the business model. If you have a financial instrument, a debt instrument, interest, spread risk is impacting the financial instrument. If it is amortized cost of fair value for the I or fair value P&L reported. And therefore, I think that is not really a factor which we should increase or that we should now bring into the application guide. Or do you mean really that also that the risk of certain financial instruments are included in the internal performance reporting to key management around. What is meant by that? Because I think risk has an impact on all financial instruments and independent of in which business model.
It could be, and I think interest risk or managing interest rate risk could be relevant to all the business models. But when you've got a, let's say you've got a hold to collect business model, your main, the main risk you want to manage with that business model is usually credit risk. You want to protect the collection of your principal.
But maybe
it could
other
be
interest
rate, it could be interest rate risk.
Liquidity risk or whatever.
But it's usually credit risk. Whereas for the other business models, it could be another risk. So it's not just internal performance. It's also the way it's reported externally to investors or included in the financial statement.
I'm not sure, because I think you have to manage liquidity risk, interest rate risk, and credit risk, and if you have a debt financial instrument, and it's not dependent on which business model you held it, because you want to manage this risk that is independent from in which business model you held it. That is my understanding. And therefore, I think it is not a good distinguishing factor for a business model.
These are meant to be indicators. I guess if you happen to manage your interest rate risk exactly the same across your whole organization, they wouldn't be relevant. But if you, for example, on your mortgage book manage your credit, your interest rate risk by looking at the cash flows you expect, but on your trading book you'll look at the pricing of those cash flows. So you might actually have different ways. In that case, it is an indicator as well. So I guess, I read these more as being, if they apply, use them. If they don't apply, move on and use something else. And I think there are circumstances where you say you would manage it differently. There are other circumstances where you might manage it differently.
But I would not agree with that, because I think it is independent of the business model. If you have a decision to manage this kind of risk, it is a separate decision about of the business model.
you want to hold to collect is different. If you have, because interest rate risk management has to do with asset and liability mix. But we're doing really this classification based on only the asset and not really on the business model, which includes the liability side. Therefore, interest rate is totally independent of which business model do you have.
I'm not sure I agree with you. I would think that
the fact if you're managing it as an asset and liability, looking at the flows you expect, in other words, you're trying to match your fixed book to your fixed book over a long period of time, that's indicative to me of a hold to collect business. If, on the other hand, you're matching, you're managing the prices and you're looking at the prices on a day-to-day basis of the interest rate, that tells me something different. No, I don't disagree with you that that's always the case. I think sometimes it will be, but there's no difference. But I think it's one of the starting points you could start from, I thought.
But I would think interest rate risk management is maybe done for the instruments which are in amortized cost portfolio and including the fair value of the I portfolio. And I don't see any distinguishing factor. Maybe it is a little bit more if you're looking at fair value P&L with day-to-day trading. But this is the way how it is, performance is assessed in that, but not how risk are managed. This is what I think. Okay.
Can I just jump in here? Just to clarify, I think the staff addressed your point, Martin, in paragraph 70 to some degree, by saying, and I think this is one of the most important changes we're introducing here among the most important, I think, is clarification as to what a business model means. But putting that aside, the application guidance would be clarified to state that the level at which we're talking about here refers to groups of financial assets managed together to achieve a particular common objective, i.e., for example, to achieve a certain, you know, asset liability management objective, I think, would in my view, qualify. The question, I guess, is, you know, how broadly or narrowly are you going to interpret that guidance, I think, is maybe something we need to discuss. But I think the staff is moving along the lines in which you're suggesting here. And I think I agree with Daryl's comments. I'm not reading this to be very restrictive or prescriptive.
But again, and if you, the most important thing is to distinguish between amortized cost and maybe fair value OCI. And if you look at the debt instrument, I think in the interest rate risk management, I think they include both instruments, and nobody is caring about if it's amortized cost or fair value either. So that interest rate risk, I think, is not a distinguishing factor. Credit risk, I think, is also treated in the same. And what I can imagine then for a debt instrument is liquidity risk and operational risk. And I think there is not any difference if it is held in a business model amortized cost of fair value for the life. That is where
I agree. I think what we're trying to focus on not so much is the presence of the risks, which I think is sort of common everywhere. It's more how you manage the risks and what actions that means to, and in particular what that means from a cash realization perspective. So if I go back to Jan's example, if I'm looking at changes in interest rates to look for opportunities to make gains and reinvest, that's a different sort of focus on interest rate risk management and consequences to if I've got my banking book and I'm using derivatives to manage my interest rate risk with hedging activity. So you do have interest rate risk in both cases, but the way that you're managing it has a consequence for cash realization, which has a consequence for how we think about the business model. So maybe we just haven't articulated clearly enough what it is about the risk that we care about, so we can have a look at that.
Philippe?
I'd like to return for a while to the section that deals with the role of sales, the business model assessment.
Zach, begin with it.
Are you confident that the way we draft it without any bright lines, without any quantitative assessment of how much shares are permitted,
will be able to be applied and enforced in a consistent manner?
We are using very qualitative sectors, integral, incidental, what is integral, what is incidental, and then we go on more foundation, saying you do a holistic assessment. Wonderful. I love holistic assessment, but in practice, you can justify many things under the term holistic assessment. So, shall we give some examples of the type of activities which would be considered as incidental, not in amount, but in nature, to illustrate a little bit the notion? For instance, if you are bound by the regulators to do some sales to provide liquidity to the market. That can be seen as incidental because the whole disaster is still to hold, but you have to do some liquidity. Selling because of credit risk protection might be seen as incidental, etc. But if we don't provide this kind of guidance, you will have people who say, oh, no, this is integral or this is incidental, and prove to me the contrary. Can you prove it?
This agenda paper only deals with the general overall assessment of the business model and what you should take into account. When we talk about the other agenda papers which deal specifically with hold to collect or hold to collect and sell, we've got some more guidance in those to assess the role of sales and talk about whether it should be significant and frequent or integral. So, and also those agenda papers include examples of activities that would be consistent and would not be consistent with that business model.
I think the reason why it's very important that we have as clear guidance as possible is that because we take a very soft approach to the consequences in 58, it has seen if their flows are realized in a different way from what was expected, what happened? Well, nothing. No assessment, no change to the classification of the remaining assets. So it's very open, it's very flexible. We are very soft. So I think I can accept that we are soft on the consequences, but I think we really need to have a relatively clear guidance on what is acceptable or not. Otherwise, you have people just abusing this classification.
PK? And then Mary, let me go to Nora.
Yeah, two things. First is that we should have a collectability test. Come on, Barry, smile. It's okay. I want to ask you something. Since it's an education session, I just wanted to. I have not had a chance to go back and look at the ED or anything, so I profess that I have not done that. In paragraph 44 through 48, you talk about the information that should be considered when making the business model assessment. Just when I was reading this, it occurred to me, what if I'm a new bank? How do I do this? There is no mention about, because there is so much of copious help you're giving to people to assess and all that. It would be, in my mind, helpful if you put something about how do you do it in a new bank. For example, in India, the central bank is considering giving license up to 13 new banks, which would be major. And so I think it would be wise to talk about that. The second thing I wanted to ask is that what, if any, information that I should be considered at the time of transition to involve what is my past practice? I'm a bank, but I am shifting from some other regime to this, or from IAS 39 to this regime. Could be two regimes, or under FASB. What information do I need to consider? What should I eliminate? Because how much I should be beholden to the past, how much I should be considered. So I think I was hoping that there's some discussion on it. So if you can help us illustrate that, that would be helpful. Second point, this is my real second point, not the collectability threshold, which is a joke on revenue, but the role of sales in the business model assessment, and those of you who have been there since 2009 know about my objection to this. I just feel, I appreciate you saying that don't look at it in isolation, look at it in a holistic fashion, but my fear is that there is some tendency to water down the sales notion, and it's just by reading this that my feeling is that that perhaps we are de-emphasizing when I know the changing fears, I know all those things, I appreciate all those things, but I think there is sales has always been an area of a concern to me in particular, and I think the language suggests that. Look at in the whole gamut of things. I don't know what is the whole gamut of things. And when we go to the next paper, we see the FASB and IASB as different interpret guidances, especially in credit concentration issues and things like that, regulator sales and things like that. So I'm just getting worried that this could be an area remember, in practice, they're not looking at those things. They're looking at these things that are going to really make the determination. So I really feel that there is some watering down, and I am not exactly happy about it. So.
Mary?
Overall, first reaction in terms of staff recommendations, specifically about the business model, support your idea that the board not try to specify or mandate the level, that it be a matter of fact rather than accounting policy. And I think there's a pretty clear discussion in here about, you know, it's clear, I think it's paragraph 39, that it's not instrument by instrument and that an entity can have more than one model. And actually, it's more when I got into the other paper, 6B and 6C, where we kept talking about an instrument being held by a business model. And I found that confusing because a business, you know, and then I started to think, does that mean portfolio? Does that mean entity, et cetera? So I think we have maybe a language or drafting issue, but I don't think a business model is what holds instruments. And I think that kind of language may be the source of some of the confusion. That's the issue addressed in this paper 6A about at what level is a business model. So let's think about that as we look back at the words and standards and see if that is maybe some of the source of the confusion, because I think the comments that you offered here I agree with.
So if I understand what you mean,
when you look at papers, I think it's 6B and 6C, it repeatedly says if X instrument is held by a business model.
Held in the business model.
No, it says by very often.
Yes,
do you just mean something as simple as held in a business model?
I don't know if it's
according to.
I just wanted to think about how we phrase it, because as I thought through all three papers.
I'm trying to work out whether it's an English thing or it's a definitional
thing. I'm trying to work that out too.
I think it's an English thing.
I think it may be that too, but I think our almost paranoia about saying in a portfolio that's within a business model or something, we're so afraid to give hints that we talk about something that doesn't happen, because, I mean, let me in some danger cross over to the hedge accounting document. Well, we're very clear in terms of saying there's an objective and a strategy, and here's how they're different. And here we talk about what it isn't, more than what it is.
Okay.
If I may jump in on this one, we have the same problem of wording in paragraph 45, where you say, defined by the way in which the performance of the business model is evaluated, risk that affects the performance of the business model, where I think what is assessed, what is managed, is a business unit, a portfolio, an entity, a subsidiary, a group, or whatever. It's not a business model. A business model is a process you apply in achieving a certain objective,
not an entity.
And I get that there's a business model
for a business model.
Right. And it's not tied to a legal entity or something like that. But I think that may be the source of some of the confusion.
Yeah. Okay. Off to you, Jim. Off to New York.
Okay. Good morning. Tom?
Oh, Russ is there. Oh, I haven't seen you, Russ. How are you?
I have three issues, but I think the most important one is the point that's made in paragraph 68B when describing the meaning of the term business model. I think what the staff is doing most effectively here is in paragraph 68B, and that's the last phrase, how activities and risks are managed to create value. And that addresses some of the points Martin was making and Daryl and Pat were reacting to, and what Sue said. I think that's the key issue that we're trying to achieve within this memo. I think we need to emphasize this. And that's the reason why the description of business activities, I believe, need to be integrated more with value creation or value realization and not relegated as a separate issue within implementation guidance. Because if we look at how activities and risk are managed to create value, if we think about interest rate risk, and that might be a really good example to put in all of the areas. If you're managing interest rate risk within a trading portfolio, you're exploiting those interest rate changes to create value through sale on a timely basis. If you're doing it within a held-to-collect or sale model, what you're doing is managing interest rate risk by looking at duration mismatches and fixing those duration mismatches by selling when the mismatch arises. If you have interest rate risk in a held-to-collection model, you're collecting out those particular assets over time and managing the interest rate risk not through sales, but by perhaps hedging or just by matching from the start in your book. And so to really be able to understand how this works together requires a statement about risks tied to how you realize value. And my particular biggest concern about the set of papers is we still talk about a model that is about value realization, and that's how we describe it in the standard, and the implementation guidance sort of talks about risks, but not sort of separately. Where really, to be able to make this work, you got to tie it together. My view. The second point I want to make is I'm very troubled by two sentences in the so-called non-tainting guidance. In particular, paragraph 72B, the middle sentence of B says, rather, such information should be considered in the context of the reason for those sales and the conditions that existed at the time as compared to the existing conditions. I have no idea what that really means. But let's say you're in a held-to-collect business model. The reason why you sold is interest rates went up greatly, significantly, went down significantly, and you got, not up, down significantly, and you got a gain position. That's the reason for the past sales, which is not consistent with the held-to-collect business model. But if you compare that reason to the existing time period where interest rates are really high and you never think really low and you don't think they're ever going to be able to go down again to get a gain, you're not going to repeat that activity, that sentence could be read to say, that's okay. In the current existing conditions, I don't expect ever the interest rates to go down sufficiently to generate those sales, so I must be in a held-to-collect model. I don't really see that sentence working very well whatsoever. I think it, again, has to be tied to the management of risks and the methods for realizing value. And if you're selling for other than for reasons other than how you manage those risks to realize value, that's a problem. And the third point is at the last clause in the sentence in C, which says you can sell. It's not going to cause a problem as long as the entity considered all relevant and objective information that was available at the time it made the assessment. That's a huge opening for second-guessing with hindsight bias. I mean, if I'm an auditor in that setting and someone asserts that I'm not going to sell, but then I end up de-selling, and you have to guess whether they really contemplated in selling for reasons that wouldn't be contemplated in that business model, in hindsight you'd say, you didn't consider all the information at that time period. That was a bad classification. So it was an error, which seems to be an even bigger penalty than tainting.
Well, Jim?
So I'll start with my last point, which was Tom. That does seem like a pretty big hurdle to say whether you considered all relevant and objective information. We see that in other standards when we set out the criteria of considering all available information. And so now you have a sale. It's inconsistent with what you asserted was the business model up front, and going back and figuring out, well, was there a piece of information within the confines of all that you didn't consider? So I thought this was going to be just a recipe for at least potential second guessing. And then I had a little bit of the same concern as talk in terms of the interaction of the guidance here on tainting and the reclassification of business model, where here I guess it says if you act in a manner that might appear to be inconsistent with your original assertion, as long as you consider it all, it doesn't call into question your old assertion, it doesn't call into question your current classification, and because business models rarely change, it doesn't suggest that your business model changed, yet you might be acting inconsistent with what you asserted that business model was. So I was a little bit confused about that interaction. I have a bunch of sales, and it doesn't call into question any of those three things. But that's where I mean, maybe a little help to me of how that sort of interplays when you actually see activity that's inconsistent with the business model.
I had had a discussion with Matt and Roel and Nick on the phone yesterday. We had this point. I thought what you were saying was it didn't call into question your existing business model, but it could call into question your future acquisitions of future assets to where they should be in a different business model.
Gotcha. So if I acquired that identical asset today, I would put it in a different business model. But because we're adverse to reclasses, we'll say that asset that would be inconsistent with the business model stays in a different business model.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to something Rihanna said a moment ago, and that was when you're first classifying an asset and trying to figure out in which business model to put it, you would consider all of the, well, trying to avoid the word all since two people already were concerned about it, but you would consider all of the information that's relevant and objective. So as part of that process, you would consider what you did with similar assets in similar or indeed the same business model. We're just trying to be clear that you would consider that information as you move forward with new assets.
So that gives me a little pause to say that if I had this identical asset, you know, I already have it and I start to act a little inconsistent, I keep it where it is. If I bought that identical asset today, I would put it in a different business model.
I think this is also exacerbated by the fact that the problem, the permitted sales are infrequent and or insignificant in the next memo. Because it suggests if the permitted sales are either infrequent and or insignificant, you could have a significant infrequent sale. You could have a really large sale, and that would be okay. And we're not going to prescribe what are sales consistent with the business model. I understand that that's going to be a challenge to prescribe it, but it's going to permit that. And that's troublesome to me.
So I think we're talking about two different things. I think Jim, what you're concerned about is we seem to have a different philosophy on the date of origination versus throughout the thing. And so you need a higher hurdle to change your business model once you're associated with the asset than when you have it. And I think you're challenging why is that line or that hurdle different depending on origination versus at the time. And then I think Tom, you might have the same concern, but I think you're also adding to it, is there enough clarity to determine whether it's at an origination or throughout what business model, because do we have sufficient clarity and do we have the right approach for determining your business model based on your ability to sell and that thing? Make sure I understand that the points that the staff can address it.
So mine is the first, and it's compounded by the statement that says a business model is a matter of fact. But in determining that fact, part of the fact is the date at which you bought the asset, because you do a different assessment over time than you do at origination.
But what you do over time, isn't it true that you're assessing over time for the purpose of the future instruments that you're going to purchase for that business model, not for the ones that you already have? And I thought that the reason that we decided not to reclassify things that we already had was just simply because it would you know, potentially make the information not as useful to have it going back and forth between these various classifications.
So I don't know what to do in my mind with that tension, but I think you end up with assets in a business model that are no longer being managed under that business model.
So does some of this, maybe I'm misunderstanding, so help me. Is some of this talking about what, the same thing Mary was talking about, what level you're making the business model assessment? Because, or maybe not, and you could stop me there.
Well, I think what Jim is saying is that the assessment, the exact point he made about, you're assessing based on fact, but in continued term, your business model has changed. The fact is that you originally put it in a category.
Sure.
So what he's saying is that if you did the reassessment every period, you'd get a different answer than the way the model is working, because the trigger to switch business models is a much higher hurdle than your original assessment of your business, where you're going to put the asset at origination.
Okay, so now I understand.
It's almost like, you know, we constantly have this tension on derecognition. Does history matter? History matters in this, and I'm not sure he thinks history matters.
And it matters because of what Daryl said, because otherwise you'd be flipping into fair value OCI and
cost,
et cetera.
But why did the change occur? If you bought or originated the asset originally, let's say because you were expecting to collect the cash flows, period.
Right.
Why did it change?
Well, that's my tension here, because it says, well, it doesn't call into question your old assessment, provided you consider it all, and it doesn't do anything with respect to its current classification. And I think sometimes things change because you have new management. Things change because you simply saw an interest rate drop that, you know, you want to take advantage of, and people don't feel necessarily confined by an accounting view of a business model.
If on day one there was the possibility that if interest rates dropped and you would experience a gain if you sold it, and you thought there was a possibility of taking advantage of that, then to me, you're not in the business for collecting cash flow.
And I would be fine with that as long as we say that results in the correction of an error.
So I think what he's saying is, okay, I buy these securities, they're all bonds, interest rates decline, I choose to sell some, okay? The next time I buy those same things, you're probably going to be forced to put it in fair value OCI or fair value P&L, not cost. But the other instruments that you have that sell of, say, 5% of your portfolio, that's going to call into question your future originations, does not call into question your current assets. That's what he's challenging. Is he's basically saying you should, because it's going to change your philosophy going forward, why doesn't it also change your philosophy for what you currently hold? And that gets back to we dealt with that pre-ED, and Daryl's point is right in how we got there. And I think he's challenging.
But also, isn't there an operational issue of trying to reassess instrument by instrument, quarter by quarter, what the right business model would be?
So I don't disagree with that, but I don't understand how that's any more difficult for the ones you hold than the ones you're buying next. And we seem to be distinguishing differently between how you use the information on your next purchase as compared to how you use that for your existing business model. And I'm particularly concerned when the answer appears to be that might result from this is don't challenge the original assessment, because there's a bias toward not correcting errors. There seems to be a bias to not reclass.
I think you're questioning fundamentally whether it makes sense to have the accounting dictated by the business model.
Right.
So let me ask you a question about business model, make sure I understand this. My business model is to originate loans for my best customers. And my best customers are not only my best borrowers, but I provide other services to them. So I have my portfolio of customers, and I'm maxed out in terms of the amount of lending that I can do today. But my absolute best customer comes in, and I've got to make room for them. And that is my business model, to serve my best customers. I haven't changed my model. I have to sell, though, because of other limitations. Is that in or out? Is that an acceptable business model? And I haven't changed anything. There are no interest rates involved. There's no credit deterioration. I'm serving my best customer. What do I do?
What do you do with that investment once you serve them?
I put it in my portfolio, and my business model is to hold those loans. My particular customers don't want their loans sold. They don't want them out in the marketplace. But I tell them, if you're not in my best customer pool, there's a chance you can be sold.
Would seem to me you have two different business models, one's for your best customers and one's for not.
No. It's like going to check in to get upgraded. There's always a chance somebody who's a better customer than me comes in. But as long as there's no better customer, I'm being held in that portfolio.
Oh, you're just saying the best customer.
The best customer at that particular point in time.
For more money.
I think it was Tracy.
Yeah. So I haven't changed anything. We're getting focused on credit deterioration changes in rates, but this is, I think, more representative of what actually happens. It's not about concentrations of risk. It's about serving your best customers. I'm personally not troubled by this. I think that I don't want to have accounting stand in the way of good business practice, consistent with your model, your value creation, to Tom's point earlier on. I think that what we're forgetting, though, is that we've got backstops. We have cost and fair value of all these dollar amounts that are on the face. We have roll forwards. I can assess whether or not you're starting to play games with, sales. I have all that information, so I'm not troubled by this, but I'm trying to fit it into this discussion. And this is much more real life than a lot of the other things we're talking about.
I think we exacerbate and create the problem by overemphasizing the value creation part of the business models. Because if we are emphasizing future value realization, and in every portfolio you can collect or sell, it's just a relative amount of how often you sell and the timing of it, you're going to have ex post bias every time and having to guess the reason for individual sales. And that's why I was arguing last time and why I argued just before that we need to be elevating the business activity into the value creation mode to think far differently about trading versus investing versus lending.
And I thought the way you described that was very useful to me in terms of getting my head around it. But then I immediately jumped to the conclusion that the only activity that you would have for hold to collect would be managing credit risk, period. I don't think it would be manageable to say that you could react to interest rate risk or liquidity risk or what have you. The only thing for hold to collect that I thought would be appropriate for you to react to in terms of an activity would be credit.
In terms of react to meaning sell?
Yes.
I think that's a natural consequence that we have to think about, and what sort of credit changes would permit that to happen. Because interest rate risk, if you're holding to collect, you don't
care about interest rate risk, assuming you did something on the liability side to feel comfortable with it.
And you hedge the position to the point where you wanted it, right?
Right.
Hopefully at initiation, but at any point in time.
By the way, that seems to be a lot of what the staff has recommended in the next paper on hold to collect. The activities are focused on when can I sell, credit mitigation. I mean, concentration, you could say, is a form of credit mitigation.
Right. Matt gave me a 101 listen this morning.
So,
Hal, do you think in your scenario when you're selling the loan to not the best customer, that is a form of because you're managing credit?
No, I think I'm managing profitability. I'm creating more value in the portfolio by getting rid of a less profitable customer and replacing with a more profitable customer.
So you'd be okay in that scenario allowing for sales for that reason?
Yes.
But you would not, Larry. Is that right?
Well, I haven't gotten my head around that.
I think he's in a fair value OCI model. He's got a portfolio of customers. Only the best one does he hold, and all the rest he sells.
It's part of the reason why I raised it, because I think you're always in that situation, you're always somewhat capital constrained. Mm-hmm. You always are considering upgrading your portfolio, improving profitability. That's your business model, regardless of where you are. Then everything becomes OCI.
Don't you have to consider the relative significance, if you will, of that? I mean, if you're only talking about your best customer or your worst customer, I mean, it's a fairly insignificant part of your total portfolio, so I'm not troubled by that.
But I always know
if you're if you're turning over half or, you know.
Well, now you're talking about a volume. So 3% is okay, but 8% is not? Because at different points in time, my customers may need more or less capital. So in periods of expansion, and my best customers are coming to me with opportunities, I may have 10%, 15%, 20%.
So why are those sales okay for Holt to collect, but sales because of liquidity purposes are not okay?
I frankly am not troubled by sales at all. Because as I pointed out before, I have multiple data points upon which to assess how I, from an investor standpoint, want to analyze that particular institution. I'm not advocating, and I'm not a strong supporter of solely amortized cost. I know I'm going to look at, on a spectrum, I'm going to look at amortized cost more in certain fact patterns and fair value in others. And that roll forward of sales helps me understand where I should be on that spectrum of analyzing it. Fair value versus cost.
Which is why you've always said you want both.
I want both, exactly. I think we're trying to draw this line, whether it's here or in leases or in any of these other projects, these lines are illusory. You cannot make the decision.
Mm-hmm. So then you, if I read you correctly, would probably say, why not just have fair value P&L and amortized cost with fair value information disclosed for the amortized cost?
As long as I'm getting both pieces of information, my preference in this world that we live in today would be mostly fair value and not cost, but that's not the model we're going down. Because I think reality is, in this day and age, there's much more management of portfolios, as we're learning, as we've learned from this feedback. It's not a simple hold-to-collect model. No one has, or let me rephrase that, very few entities have a solely hold-to-collect model. It's always a blend of at least hold-to-collect and what we're considering fair value OCI. So, and I asked the staff this morning, should we be considering or giving examples of, in my $100 of loans in this typical hold-to-collect portfolio, 5% of it is always going to be fair value OCI. So, because I always know I'm going to be turning some portfolios, they're going to be pairs, so I do 10%, others zero, but I'm always going to have some sale. Do I split the portfolio? Nick suggests to me that creates some operational difficulties. I agree, but that's the reality. So we either should permit it or push everybody in fair value OCI or do something, but let's reflect the reality of the situation we're dealing with.
Matt? How is another method to reconsider lowering the bar for reclassifications?
Are we ready to go to the next paper, perhaps? Or?
Matt just talked a quick
one. Oh, I'm sorry.
Matt David, we're ready to go on.
Yeah? Okay. Nick, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Agenda Paper 6B, SASB Memo 250, discusses the hold-to-collect business model for the amortized cost measurement category. This paper provides the relevant background information, including a summary of the proposed guidance for the hold-to-collect business model. It summarizes the relevant feedback received from the FASB and IASB respondents on the hold-to-collect business model, and it provides staff analysis and recommendations. IFRS 9, the limited amendment CD, and the FASB's proposed ASU have a consistent notion of the hold-to-collect business model. That is, for financial assets to be measured at amortized cost, they must be held within a business model whose objective is to hold those assets to collect contractual cash flows. Feedback received by the IASB and the FASB, including feedback from users, has indicated general support for measuring financial assets at amortized cost if the assets are held within a business model whose objective is to hold those assets to collect contractual cash flows. questions and concerns expressed by both IASB and FASB respondents not relate to that principle per se, but rather largely related to the perceived overly restrictive scope of the hold-to-collect business model, particularly regarding the frequency, volume, and nature of sales considered consistent with the hold-to-collect objective. The staff analysis and discussion section of this paper is broken up into two subsections. The first subsection discusses potential clarifications and enhancements to the hold-to-collect business model. The second subsection specifically discusses the role of sales when assessing the hold-to-collect business model. Consistent with the staff recommendations in IASB Agenda Paper 6A, FASB Memo 249, in order to improve the clarity of the guidance and assist preparers in applying the hold-to-collect business model assessment, the staff recommends that the boards discuss and provide examples of the specific activities that are commonly associated with the hold-to-collect business model and that are aimed at achieving the objective of that business model, and provide guidance on the nature of the information an entity would consider in assessing the hold-to-collect business model. Paragraph 44 of the paper provides examples of activities the staff believes would commonly be associated with the hold-to-collect business model, while paragraphs 46 through 48 describe the nature of the information the staff believes an entity should consider when assessing a hold-to-collect business model. With respect to the role of sales out of the hold-to-collect business model, the staff recommends that the boards emphasize that insignificant and or infrequent sales are not inconsistent with the hold-to-collect business model, regardless of the reasons for such sales. The staff notes that infrequent or insignificant sales do not contradict the overall objective of holding financial assets to collect contractual cash flows, and amortized costs would provide useful and relevant information. The staff also recommends that the boards do not quantify the notions of infrequent and insignificant sales, and instead clarify that determining when sales are insignificant and or infrequent is a matter of judgment and would be based on facts and circumstances. In addition, the staff recommends that the boards clarify that credit risk management activities aimed at minimizing potential credit losses due to credit deterioration are integral to the hold-to-collect objective. Some staff members recommend stating in the guidance that sales of financial assets due to changes in credit concentration risk, such that the financial assets no longer meet an entity's documented investment policy and/or credit risk management protocols, should be considered consistent with the objective of holding to collect contractual cash flows. Other staff members recommend clarifying the guidance to state that sales made in managing credit concentration risk are only consistent with an objective of holding to collect contractual cash flows if the asset's credit quality has deteriorated or such sales are infrequent and/or insignificant. Do the boards have any comments or questions on the staff analysis and recommendations?
Hans, do you want to start or you want us to start?
Why don't you start,
Okay. Anybody want to start?
So, on that last point for the staff that recommended infrequent or insignificant, I think the word is, and or. So, then if you had a portfolio in a particular geographic area, and for whatever reason that the credit quality for that geographic area went down significantly and you just wanted to minimize it and get rid of the entire portfolio, but it didn't qualify for insignificant, then that would be precluded?
I think that would be okay. I think the concept is credit deterioration. Sales for credit deterioration is always okay. So no matter how often or frequent it is, if it relates to credit deterioration, it's okay. I think what the distinction in the credit concentration that I talked about at the end there is, there's some of the staff believe that basically credit sales for credit concentration should go into the general or the general model for sales, which is, are they related to credit deterioration? If yes, they're okay. If no, they need to be insignificant and or infrequent.
Okay.
There are other staff who say that credit concentration limits are set with an eye towards the whole point of them is to minimize credit losses and maximize collection of cash flows. So they are consistent with the objective of collecting contractual cash flows.
You good? Jim?
just make sure I understand, is in operation, I could frequently sell insignificant things and then infrequently sell significant items. Do I need to aggregate the insignificant sales, or if I weekly sold insignificant amounts, but in the aggregate over a quarter, a year, or 2 years, it looks significant? Or how do you do the insignificant test?
I think the guidance currently, or at least in the limited amendment CD and what we propose in the paper, is the insignificant threshold is looked at both individually and in the aggregate. So you would, you know, you'd look at the individual sale, and you look at the end of a quarter, you'd say,
so you can't rebalance. Yeah, you can't rebalance weekly and say, well, each one of those is
each one of those individually was insignificant, right?
So it's not. Well, you answer my question. Yeah, Daryl.
Just a quick. This is a preference in terminology, and it feels like this has been brought up before, maybe at the table or at least in a comment letter, but. When we say certain sales are not inconsistent with an objective, does that mean the same things as certain sales are consistent with the objective? Could we not say it more directly? And I mean, I don't mind for the board memos, we can understand, but it just seems like it creates potential for confusion amongst constituents.
Tom?
I'm generally concerned in this memo that will open up the possibility to sell for many, many reasons. And I'm disturbed by several examples in the memo. The first ones are in paragraph 48. The last one is particularly disturbing to me. Similarly, any financial asset could be potentially sold if an entity is offered the right price on such asset. That's not inconsistent with a held-to-collect strategy if you're not trying to maximize fair value. So you can sit there and say, I'm going to collect the cash flows until I have a big enough gain and I'm going to sell. But it's not really to maximize the gains. It's just good value creation. I don't see how that's remotely consistent with the held-to-collect strategy. That sounds like a fair value OCI strategy. I hold it, and I'll sell it if I can make money off it, maximizing return. So I don't understand that example.
I think the I'll speak and then let others chime in, but I think the point of that example was in some of the feedback and the outreach that we had done, we'd heard that My entire portfolio is for sale for the right price.
Then how can you assert held to collect?
Well, I think the concept in Rihanna's paper, we talked about this, that yes, anything may be for sale for a ridiculous price, but you don't assess the business model based on sort of what if scenarios that you don't reasonably expect to occur.
Well, except if you have financial instruments with long durations that you're originating, and let's say you originate them during a very, am I going the right way, high interest rate environment, right? And then interest rates start plummeting. You're basically saying that a company might react by selling it to interest rate changes. And if that's the case, then to Tom's point, you weren't holding it just for cash collections.
Well, I think that's
scenario.
I think.
I was just going to say, I think we were just trying to. Some people think that if they ever sell anything, that means it could never be a held to collect business model. So what say if just once they sold something because such a good opportunity came along? Because it does say, and such sales are infrequent or insignificant. So it's subject to it only being a sort of a one-off or tiny. And it's
that's not what that sentence says.
It just says, and such sales are infrequent and or insignificant.
Well, what bothers me is and or. So you could do a large significant sale for interest rate risk purposes.
But infrequent over what time period? I can go back to
once in 2 years,
any number of cycles, and yeah, I could find the exact same situation or fact pattern 20 and 30 and 40 years ago, and there was a sale.
And at least that's why I think to make this work, we've got to talk about the business model, the lending activities, the health of collection, management of credit risk, and decide about which one of which sales consistent with that model makes some sense. And then for all other sales not consistent with that model, and it might be that it's only consistent with credit deterioration, and I can't see anticipated credit deterioration. It'd have to be realized credit deterioration. Because if you permit sales for anticipated credit deterioration in an expected credit loss model, you can sell it any time and just say, I expect to have a credit loss.
I appreciate your point, but you're standing in the way of good management. If you look out on the horizon and say, this industry, this sector, this geography, this type of customer is heading in the wrong direction, it hadn't deteriorated yet, but you're saying, no, I have to wait for an accounting purpose. I have to wait to sell?
Well, if we were to finalize the CECL model and circumstances, there would be an impairment.
Not if I sold it before the market recognized it.
No, it's your internal estimate of the problem.
But I'm also looking at my ability to realize that value before the rest of the market.
I understand, but in the accounting model, you would still recognize it.
I don't think you would. I think you would say, I think I'm going to be able to sell this quickly at this price and not recognize the full loss if I had held it for 3 years.
All I'm saying is there'd be some impairment.
There may be, but I can envision cases where there wouldn't be as well.
Okay. Well, so I just have some issues in terms of the examples as how far they go. And I'd raise the issue if it's not consistent with the redefined business activities created in value creation, whether or not we want an and/or there or just an or, insignificant or infrequent, rather than being able to be significant and infrequent. Do we want, for reasons other than the business activity, to permit significant sales inconsistent with that business activity? Doesn't seem to me consistent with a healthy collection strategy.
Anything else so far? So, Hans, why don't I turn it back to you?
Okay, thanks. Amaru, just before you start, Amaru, are you still getting some echo there?
No.
Okay.
No, the volume's fine.
Okay. Amaru, just maybe a clarification. In paragraph 46, letter C, you suggest that we also should consider future expectations. I'm a little bit bothered about assessing future expectations in a business model assessment. I think they are not consistent, actually, with a business model.
Even a business plan?
Even a business plan. That business plan is distinct from business model. We agree that business models is something that doesn't change frequently or is not expected to change frequently. So to assess expectations when I'm assessing the right classification of instrument, I think it is consistent with the business model rationale.
So Amaro, say other way, you will assess business model only based on past activity.
No, I will assess business model based on what is my business model today and my history of performing in accordance with what is my business model. Expectation is something that is really is maybe too broad or it's not certain. How do I expectation of changing the business model or the expectation of selling?
So it's about cash flow.
Let's assume a bank takes over another business, and the bank starts to formulate a new business model for whole. And for the new segment, they just bought from China or from Japan.
This is not, in my view, in your case, is not expectation anymore because you have a business model established for
No. The bank is now formulating a business model.
And for the classification purpose also.
But I think to Marlo's point, paragraph 48 is, as far as I read it, is when you make the initial acquisition of a financial instrument and you're trying to decide how to classify that financial instrument within your existing
business
model. Is that, Sue, is that, sorry, paragraph 46 is that when you, the date of initial recognition is initial recognition of an individual financial instrument. And so it's, that's why you're concerned about trying to consider, anticipate changes in your business model when you're making an individual instrument classification decision. As opposed to assessing whether or not you have forthcoming change in your business model.
But you're just saying you can't do that. You're objecting to that, right?
I believe it would be quite impractical to apply the letter C. And I think A and B are enough.
I think all we were trying to say with that was when you make your business model assessment, you actually look at historic information because that will tell you how you've done it in the past. You look at your current expectations about how you think you're going to manage them, but you also look at what are your future expectations about this new, let's say, pool of assets that you've just acquired. Do you think you're going to manage them going forward in the same way that you've managed the others and that your business model assessment is the same, or do you think that these ones are going to be managed differently, so your expectations about how those future cash flows are going to be realized is different from what your historic information is telling you?
Yeah, no, I can know my story. I can know my current expectations. I cannot know my future expectations.
No, we're not saying, but you know what your plan is today for that.
It's my current, it's B, my current objective. It's my plan today. What my plans will be tomorrow, I have no idea.
Exactly.
Maybe just drop the word future and just say your expectations.
Okay. Two things. I touched on these issues in my earlier comments. There seems to be different guidance or expanded guidance from the FASB's exposure draft when compared to the IASB's one. Two specific ones are the ones I want to talk about. Is the sales required by a regulator. And the second one I want to talk perhaps is the credit concentration. Now, let me understand the credit concentration. The FASB's proposal, at least as it stands in their proposed ASU, says that if Company A and Company B, I hold the assets of the issued by Company A and Company B, but they both merge and they become a combined entity. So the combined AB, I don't want to hold more than 5%, but now because of their holding, they have gone up to 10%. Why that is not a risk mitigating factor that should be prohibited. And don't get me wrong, I'm not enamored by your sales category. So don't even get the remotest idea that I'm in favor of it. But I'm just asking, what is the logic in considering that if there is a documented investment policy that I will not hold in any single company more than 5% of my total portfolio, that's written, that's been documented, I've been holding it, without my control, I got this kind of merger happening. Why can't I do that? And I'm just curious why we are silent, FASB is kind of no, and there is a recommendation which is split recommendation. So I'm just worried, where is this going? And the second point I want to come to is,
On this one, on credit concentration, which is one of the things, we are not saying you will immediately violate the conditions as long as you meet the infrequent and insignificant test. The condition which you're talking about, in my view, would most probably meet it because I don't expect that to be happening very frequently. What credit deterioration gives almost a free pass is that if things are credit deteriorating, the sales do not violate the conditions. It's because actually what you're trying to do is take an action to protect the collection of contractual cash flows, which is the principle. To extend it beyond that, your credit concentration, one, these policies can change. So it's an internal document. So if you change your concentration limits, then would we allow the sales to happen?
But business model is an internal document too, right?
Agreed. But we are saying that
what are the things where you don't even need to consider anything else? Remember, this is a free path. If you have credit deterioration, it's a fail, you don't need to consider.
So the view of the stop is that if it is
credit concentration, you should be okay if it's infrequent and insignificant.
Yeah, but I'm putting it in that bucket. Remember the discussion, the fact we had. If I put it in an infrequent or insignificant, there are people who would like to aggregate the insignificant, or there are people who would like to say infrequent is something that happens in a generation. But if it happens once in 2 years, one is because of... So you are necessarily hitting that mark. And if it is, and I think Hal said, if I want to react proactively and I don't like my documented policy that I don't have anything more than 5%, and it's my proactive policy, I don't want to. I don't care what it is going to happen, and it met that. And I'm just curious why that tension, because if putting it in the bucket of insignificant and or infrequent, you're accumulating those things, and I don't think
It's just because I think that our thinking is that amortized cost information is relevant information as long as most of the cash flows are contractual cash flows. And if you start to have lots of sales, you know, a noticeable amount of sales happening, then amortized cost information becomes less relevant. So I think generally the reason for the sale doesn't matter so much to me. It's the selling that matters. And so even if it's because of credit concentration balancing, selling is happening. And we make a distinction for credit deterioration because we think that's part of the protection of the cash flows. But we don't, as some of the staff, don't think it's appropriate to have a broader allowance of sales just because it's happening for a good purpose, if you like, because it's the selling that reduces this relevance. It's not the reason for the selling that matters to us.
I just feel that we are, personally, this is my view, that we are inconsistent. We are giving free passes elsewhere, and we are where a genuine free pass needs to be given. No, I'm against that. I'm just saying that credit concentration doesn't make sense for me to prohibit it for those who go down.
The other reason that we have made the recommendation that we have to limit it to significant or insignificant and infrequent is credit concentration is a very broad label that's being applied. So you can have sales for credit concentration reasons for almost any reason you can think of. It's quite easy to label any sale as a credit concentration sale without having an effect on the credit deterioration or your ability to collect the contractual cash flows. So the reason we wanted to limit it is because we think without having that link back to the credit deterioration, any other sale could be labelled as a concentration sale, and that would open it up.
Especially in terms of government policy, it could be very dangerous because all the banks, especially in Europe, are overloaded on government funds.
They
always have a good reason to sell it.
Last comment, I think you have not... please help me, what is that we are going to do at the ISB level when there is similar guidance as of date between ASB and ISB, and there is more elaboration on ASB. Do we agree with those answers and we are silent, or we don't agree with it? If you agree with it and if you're silent, I don't care. But if you don't agree and if you're silent, then I have a problem with that. So I just want to be very clear where the staff stands on it.
Gary?
A couple of comments all in the same vein. I think on paragraph 53 on credit deterioration, I buy into the principle, which is the last set line goes, needs to be clarified and emphasized. So we're asked the question, well, what's credit deterioration? Going from AA to AA minus is a credit deterioration, but it's still low risk. It's at the beginning and the end. So you don't have to get, I don't need an answer right now. I'm just perhaps pointing out the obvious, but I think if it goes from investment grade to non-investment grade, these questions are going to come, you know, if they haven't been answered already. And if I'm not necessarily looking for an answer right now, I'm just putting the issue on the table. I think my advice when managing credit risk concentration would be sort of more in the camp of, you know, less of that is, you know, the less permissive we are, not the better. The number of reasons, one is credit risk concentration can be expressed in many different ways. There's a point estimate, say 5% in municipal bonds, or they can be expressed as, you know, is 3 to 9% investment bonds. So one guy's got a very precise measure of concentration risk, and he's permitted to do things or not do things, where someone's got a wide range can do the exact same transaction and be assessed differently inside of here. So the other thing is, having been a pension trustee, is the concentration targets change. But you're also not expected to necessarily change if you're the asset manager the next day. You're using a window to change. You can also manage your concentration of risk. Right? As new money comes in tomorrow, you invest it separately and just sort of gradually trend it down, you know, just maturities. Then the last comment on page 60, or paragraph 60, is this close to maturity. Again, I would agree with that shouldn't be a problem. Would you consider, if the issuer has call options in it, they decide to call it, that would make it close to a maturity? I mean, a lot of bonds do, and loans do. And if they started calling them much before maturity, you know, would that change your opinion on this? Again, you don't have to answer right now, as long as you don't lose the question.
Cash flow.
Expected
contractual cash flow.
From the issuer side, not the whole.
Thank you. This question is related to paragraph 26 and also related to Tom and Howard's discussion. So, dear, whether we are providing some answer on this commentator's kind of suggestion, that is, they are going to, in practice, they are selling some debt investment quite before there is some credit deterioration. So Tom and Tom serves some kind of negative response. That kind of thing happening, but already our feedback had such a kind of situation. In practical world, maybe banks and some other financial institutions will sell those investments very early and the credit deteriorating. So in that case, what happens? If another thing is if the expectation can be right later, or sometimes maybe wrong. So this kind of situation we should provide some kind of guidance.
Simple to respond to your question and also to comment on the first point that Gary raised. So the whole question about sales due to credit deterioration, we did get the feedback, and so we do clarify in the paper, specifically in paragraph 54, that you do not need to wait until you actually have incurred losses. You don't have to wait until you see the transfer point under the impairment model, which is under the development right now, but you must have deterioration. You don't have to wait until it's too late, but you must have deterioration. And now the question is, well, if I go from AAA to AA, is that deterioration? Is it enough for me to sell? And again, the paragraph to which Gary referred, paragraph 53, it's actually in the context of the discussion in the existing proposals. And in the existing proposals, we say that deterioration must be addressed in your investment policy or investment guidelines. So if your investment policy says, you know, if I go from AAA to BBB, that's enough deterioration for me to exit this sort of instrument, then that would be okay. So you still need to prove that there was enough deterioration for you to sell.
Process this separately, so I'm not sure. AAA to double. The AAA to AA, not a lot of deterioration. I don't care what your investment guidelines say. The default risk is infinitesimally different. Again, we don't have to process it now.
Stephen?
I was actually going to say the same thing as Gary. So I agree with what he said on credit deterioration, credit concentration. I don't think we should give a free pass on that, but I agree with what Gary said.
Paragraph 45.
I like this negative list. Perhaps this may relate to the next paper, C. what is the residual? Because this paragraph 45 negative list is quite understandable. Is there any plan for you to include this kind of negative list in your guidance?
In the actual exposure draw?
Yeah.
Or in the final stand?
Okay,
Martin.
And I'm really thinking what is important is what staff have said in the paragraph 38, and that is what we also discussed, I think, in the former paper. It's, if you're reading that, that really the focus on how financial assets are actually managed in order to generate cash flow and create value for the entity. An example, whether the likely actual cash flow will result primarily from the collection of contractual cash flow, sales proceeds, or both. And if we think that is true, and we think amortized cost is only a relevant measure really if you want to collect contractual cash flows, I think the debate which we have, what is the reason for the number or frequency or significance or not of sales, is not is irrelevant. Because I think it doesn't matter. Because if you have frequent and I think high number or important or a significant amount of sales, then really amortized costs don't give you any information about future cash flows. And if that comes then, the number of sales or the frequency from management of interest rate risk, concentration risk, credit concentration risk, or from a regulator which then will force you to doing that, but if that number of sales is then frequent or significant, I think then amortized costs doesn't give you, and that is the basis of the model. Therefore, I think what we're discussing here, what are the reasons for that, is irrelevant. For me, at least, it's irrelevant. Because if the number of sales are infrequent and insignificant, doesn't matter, then you can go with amortized costs. If it is not, then I think maybe you are in a different business model and you should have care value with the IOR. I think that's the basic what we're discussing. And clearly, in a business model, what we discuss, credit risk, clearly we're thinking about lending business. Credit risk is managed. But if credit risk is managed, for example, by a frequent number of layers of the portfolio, nobody would think, okay, that then amortized cost is a good measure for this kind of portfolio. Because if you have frequent number of layers and this sales amounts are really totally different from the amortized cost amount, I don't think amortized cost gives a good information. So if, for example, a bank would say, okay, and I'm doing my credit risk management, every year I'm selling and buying 50% of my portfolio. Do we think that is a good information than amortized cost? I don't think so. And I think what we discussed regarding that sale based on credit risk management activity, if it is already deteriorated, I think we conclude because we have, in addition to the amortized cost information, we have the impairment information. And both together, then maybe then it's a good prediction of future cash flow. But if we don't have really a significant deterioration already, I think, and then we have frequent sales, I think amortized cost is not giving us good information. Philippe?
A question about the sales and the fact that we do not prohibit, if I understand correctly, having similar instruments classified under two business models. So if I have a portfolio of bonds, which I usually intend to hold to maturity, but for some reason I need to create liquidity. Can I, and this has been discussed when we went to Germany with Martin, can I separate my portfolio into two sub-portfolios, one being classified at amortized cost, and this one doesn't move, except if I have credit deterioration, and another one being fair value to OCI, which is the one where I do this liquidity activity. It's okay.
It would be okay to do that if you can honestly prove that you're managing those two separately, or you're managing them in different ways.
What does it mean, managing separately? Maybe the same people are managing the two.
Well, if you have sales, it is really out of the one that is measured
as sales. It's a kind of segregation. You would have a segregation of the portfolios, and you would.
The problem is that when you sell, you have to know exactly which number of that instrument to sell to which portfolio it belongs to.
Because otherwise it just becomes an accounting construct.
Okay, let's finally move to the Thanks, Anne. So the third paper for today's joint education session discusses the hold to collect and sell business model that results in measurement at fair value OCI and the residual category that results in measurement at FVPL. As noted earlier, the business model assessment received overall support from the constituents. Therefore, similar to earlier papers, this paper does not recommend any fundamental changes to the two fair value categories, but rather discusses clarifications that can be made in response to the feedback received. The background section of the paper provides an overview of the proposed guidance for both hold to collect and sell and the residual category. IFRS 9 currently does not contain a fair value OCI measurement category for eligible debt instruments. Under IFRS 9, all eligible debt instruments are classified at either amortized cost or fair value through P&L. The boards jointly decided to propose that financial assets with eligible contractual cash flows should be mandatorily measured at fair value OCI if they are managed both to collect contractual cash flows and to sell. Furthermore, both boards propose that fair value through P&L should be the residual measurement category, that is, financial assets would be measured at fair value through P&L if they do not qualify to be measured at either amortized cost or fair value through OCI. The application guidance in both IASB's Limited Amendments ED and the FASB's proposed ASU provided guidance on how the hold to collect and sell business model should be assessed, including guidance on both the types of activities and the frequency, volume, and nature of sales that would be consistent with such a business model. The feedback section of this paper summarizes the feedback received on both fair value categories. In summary, the majority of respondents agreed with having two fair value measurement categories where the fair value through OCI measurement category is defined and fair value through P&L measurement category is the residual category. While they supported the fair value through OCI measurement category generally, many respondents expressed concerns about the clarity of how the fair value through OCI model was described. Some specifically commented on the differences in the board's articulation of the business model for fair value through OCI measurement and noted that an entity does not have an objective to hold and to sell financial assets. These respondents noted that holding and selling are the result of how financial assets are managed to achieve a specific objective. In other words, holding and selling are outcomes of a business model, not an objective. A minority of respondents commented that fair value through OCI should not be a defined business model, but rather an option or the residual measurement category. These stakeholders therefore proposed having fair value through OCI as a residual measurement category rather than fair value through P&L. The first section of the staff's analysis and recommendation discusses retaining fair value through OCI as a measurement category and highlights that staff continues to believe that fair value through OCI measurement category is necessary in order to properly classify and measure financial assets that are acquired or originated for activities which result in both holding to collect contractual cash flows and selling. Therefore, we recommend that the boards retain the fair value through OCI measurement category. With regards to whether fair value through OCI should be the residual category rather than being a defined category, the staff recommends that fair value through OCI should be retained as a defined measurement category since it provides useful information for business models where both collection of contractual cash flows and the realization of cash flows through sales are integral to achieving the objective. As discussed in the paper, the staff believes that neither amortized cost nor fair value through OCI would be useful as a residual measurement category. Consistent with the board's discussion last year, leading to their respective exposure draft, the staff also continues to believe that defining fair value through P&L would be difficult and may allow entities flexibility in determining whether financial assets would be classified at fair value through P&L or fair value through OCI. The second section of the staff's analysis and recommendation discusses clarifications to the proposed application guidance for both the fair value categories. With regards to fair value through OCI category, the staff recommends that the boards clarify that managing financial assets to both collect contractual cash flows and for sale is the outcome of the way in which these assets are managed rather than an objective in itself. both collection and sales are integral to the performance of the fair value through OCI measurement category. The staff also recommends that there should be included an examples of activities that are typically consistent with the fair value OCI business model. These could include holding the assets in a liquidity portfolio in which selling significant portion of portfolio are frequently sold to meet liquidity needs, matching the duration of financial assets to that of liabilities they are funding, maintaining a particular yield profile or managing exposure to interest rate risk by holding and selling financial assets in accordance with a stated risk management policy, and monitoring key performance indicator of such financial assets through contractual interest yield and impairment charges and the fair value changes. With regards to the fair value through P&L category, the staff recommend that even though this category is the residual category, its application guidance should be clarified to state that holding the assets for trading and managing these assets on a fair value basis are examples of activities that are consistent with the fair value through P&L category. All the staff recommendations are summarized in paragraph 72 and 73 of this memo. The question the staff would like to ask today is that does the board have any questions or comments on this paper? With that, I will turn it over to the board for discussion.
You mind if we start, Hans? To get it going?
Excuse me?
Why don't we start just to get it going? Jim?
Okay.
Yeah, Mark?
So I think the staff made some good steps forward here, but also I'm still confused on and I wanted to focus on the definition of fair value OCI. I like what you said in that holding to collect and selling financial instruments isn't really an objective in and of itself, but are tools to meet the objective. And I agree with that, and I think that's a major step forward. But I still don't know what that objective is. Right? So I don't think, you know, so what you've gone here, and then I'm looking at paragraph 73, you say that we should make it clear that those two things are the outcome in which they're managed to achieve a particular objective, okay? And I agree. But we haven't defined what that objective is. And then you say in the application guidance, we should say that both the collection of contractual cash flows and the realization of cash flows through selling are integral to the performance of the business model. I agree with that, but that's an application guidance. So I still don't know what I'm shooting for.
So I guess in a way, it sounds contradictory that amortized cost have an objective and fair value OCI doesn't have an objective, because holding to collect cash flows is both an objective and the strategy to achieve that objective. So it's very easy to define that. Fair value OCI could have many objectives: managing your credit, managing your interest rate, managing your yield. So either we could say that objective for fair value OCI can be defined through the activities you need to manage, because the staff believes it would be very difficult for us to state five different objectives for a category. It would be.
But if you're trying to define what the model is, because you said you don't want to make this a residual category.
Right.
So I kind of still feel like I need an objective that I'm shooting for. Maybe
I had the exact same reaction I had in here, and, you know, that you still haven't stated what the objective is. But perhaps the objective, perhaps we need to state that there might be multiple objectives. And you just mentioned several of them, you know, managing liquidity, managing to collect cash flows, et cetera, but a recognition that the entity might need to sell assets to accomplish certain of those objectives.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, we're going to provide you with both information that's relevant to amortized cost and information that's relevant to fair value. So it's just, and you can distinguish that from, it's easy to distinguish it from amortized cost. I think it's also easy to distinguish it from fair value P&L, because in fair value P&L, there is not an objective of collecting cash flows.
Okay. That could be.
Carol?
Yeah, I too had the same reaction, and when I mentioned it to Rahul yesterday, one possibility that I thought of was instead of trying to craft an objective for the fair value OCI category just because we have an objective for the amortized cost category, perhaps instead we say, okay, here are activities that are consistent with this defined category, as opposed to trying to come up with an objective. I mean, I don't know that we need an objective, because we're saying it's activities that are consistent with this, and that's what puts you into that category. Tom?
My view of an objective would be to state something like, the objective is investing to hold or sell financial assets to manage, for example, liquidity risk, duration or interest rate risk, or to maximize yield based on changes in future economic conditions. I think that's what we're trying to pull together. And I, with that sort of basis, I could say amortized cost, the objective is lending or financing activities to manage credit risk to help make sure you can collect cash flows. That's the idea that I was talking about, that separating the value realization from the activities doesn't give you a whole picture. But if you put them together, you get a much better picture. And I think that's what you're telling me in this particular set of guidance. It's just not all linked together very well. Note what I said there is whether you hold or sell depends on future economic conditions. So I don't necessarily agree with your suggestion in paragraph 73B that we don't look to the future, because I think that's what investing is about. If there are no changes in economic conditions, you might just end up holding because you don't get a duration mismatch, or you don't get a liquidity problem, or you don't have a problem with having to maximize yield because you were satisfied with what you got. Mm-hmm. And so there is the possibility that you do not frequently sell out of this category, depending on conditions, but since conditions usually do change, you end up selling. But that's the problem of ex ante versus ex post in specifying what it is. And I don't think we ought to say that you have to be guaranteed you're going to be selling as you start, because you don't know where economic conditions are necessarily going to go, but we expect that you will out of the portfolio.
Okay. Anything else, Daryl?
Can I ask just one more quick question? In the previous memo, we talked a lot about sales that would indicate in the future that certain instruments should not be put in the amortized cost category, but, you know, in essence, we're saying evidence would show that you're really in this other business model. Does it go the other way, too? In other words, if we have a bunch of financial instruments that we have put in fair value OCI, but then we look, say, after the fact, after those instruments have matured, and we find that we're not selling any of them. We're holding all of them. Would that say that in the future we should be using the amortized cost category instead?
No, that's not what the staff believes happens, because initially when you are making an assessment for an instrument, whether it should be classified at fair value OCI, at that time, you have an intention to manage some of the risk associated with that asset. You are either managing it, your interest rate risk, you're managing your liquidity, you are managing your asset liability mismatch, or you're managing your yield. And if you're managing for that, then it should go to fair value OCI. Now, I completely agree, and Rihanna, I think, said before, you can have exactly the same bond, one of which goes into amortized cost and one of which goes into fair value OCI, because your strategy to manage those was completely different from day one.
So it just so happened that you didn't need to sell any to achieve your right. your goal.
Yeah, let me say, Daryl, if you're managing interest rate risk, and over, I know this is a ridiculous scenario, but over 5 years, interest rates never moved, you wouldn't have to sell any of the bonds, but that doesn't change what your objective was. You were just reacting to what the economic environment was, which is stable, which means lower selling.
To extend that, Daryl, if you had a trading portfolio and you had a 90-day instrument and the return ended up being really high because it plummeted and you held it to the end, you would not want that to be at fair value net income? Probably not. I think in every category you can hold or sell, and that's part of the complication of defining it based simply upon the value creation, value realization mechanism.
I think we're done over here, so Hans?
Okay, Ian? Thanks, Hans. I'd like to challenge the staff's first proposition that we should retain fair value OCI category. If you go to paragraph 38, we give our reasons for doing this project. One was to clarify some things, it's not mentioned in 38, but that's where we did it. Two was to converge, and I think that's a good goal, but there's lots of ways we can converge if we can just get the two boards to agree. Third was to try and fix the problem with insurance, and that's a problem I can see, but maybe there's other ways we can fix it. And fourth, which is the first one here, says we provide useful information, and that's the one I'd really question. So if we look at the model, at one end we've got hold to collect. We're going to keep that at amortized cost and we're going to put it into the profit and loss that way. Well, that's probably okay. The other end we've got the trading assets. We're going to put them in at fair value in the balance sheet, fair value in the profit and loss. And I think that's okay too. Then we've got the ones we don't know if we're holding them to maturity or we're selling them. We're doing something in between or both. And so what we're going to do with them is we're going to take the cash collection bit and pop that into profit and loss. And we're going to take our fair value movements through OCI until we realise them, then we're going to drop a great big number, either a profit or a loss, into profit and loss. Now what does that figure mean? It's all on the realisation principle. I don't have very much agreement with the realisation principle in any case. What figures are we showing? What useful information are we giving? Maybe splitting that middle category between the increases in fair value and the sort of cash collection might be useful, but you could put both of those into profit and loss separately on separate line items if it was really useful information to show. But I question the whole basis. I don't think we're going to give any more useful information in this model. Okay, so you want to reverse to IFRS 9?
Yeah.
Apart from the insurance problem. So, what is it?
Well, just to fill in, Ian, I like that you are coming on board on the track. Just to add two things. The first is that this will allow gaming. It will allow people to dress up the numbers so that it fits their quarterly report, and it's some very well-known tricks about buying and selling bonds. And secondly, I think on the insurance we are noticing, at least I'm sensing that, there's a growing resistance against this fair value to OCI. And I don't think that we are without the solution to insurance. We can work with a fair value option and we can work with optional solutions. So I agree with you. It's time to drop this idea.
Where is this coming from?
We by the sound.
Another comment, please? What else do you expect?
Well, welcome in. I wanted to comment on key performance indicators for fair value OCI. Paragraph 66. So in there you say, we think the key performance indicators such financial assets include contractual interest, yield, impairment charges, and fair value changes. But then in paragraph 20, it says performance is affected by both contractual cash flows and realization of fair value changes. So is it both, or is it the fair value change itself?
I think, Stephen, it's both. Both fair value changes and the impairment charges and the interest yield are important for these assets.
But what about realization of fair value changes? What does that add in terms of assessing performance? Because that's the key number, because that's what drives the income statement and that's what differentiates this from fair value P&L. But does the realization of fair value changes
add something in my understanding of the performance of an entity.
So I think it goes back to the value realization in for these assets. The value realization is either I'm going to hold to collect or I'm going to sell. And the realization through sales just confirms the notion of realizing the fair value gains or losses that are being shown in OCI that are actually being realized. So I think the number is there in OCI. The movement from OCI to income statement actually proves my investing strategy is working and I'm able to realize. I think the stuff, at least from my perspective, I still believe there are three activities which an entity does: lending, investing, and trading. And that's how the model is into three buckets. That's how we define these three buckets.
But proving an ability to realize sounds a bit like level three. Let's not book some gains until we're confident. If we're dealing with level one and marketable securities, I don't think proving the ability to realize really comes into it much. Surely the key information is the fair value change. And I think a lot of what's in here, I have to struggle to find the sort of realization bit. Most of this is about fair value change. Can I also comment upon paragraph 73D and the four situations which are listed in here, and Tom was sort of kind of using some of these in his definition. So these activities that might be consistent with fair value OCI. So the first one, 73D, is that right?
Yeah.
So the first one is KPI is contractually ill impairment fair value changes. Well, if the KPI includes fair value changes, why isn't that fair value change in the income statement? Seems odd that we sort of park it somewhere else and put something else in the income statement. Financial assets held in a liquidity portfolio, significant portion of the portfolio, frequently sold. Well, surely it's the fair value change that really is the key performance indicator there, not the realization of those, because as Jan said, you can pick and choose. I don't see why fair value P&L wouldn't give the most relevant information in that situation. And then we've got this duration matching. What if we're not duration matched? Are we not in fair value OCI? If we have a situation where we're not matched, why is sort of matching so important? And of course then if you sell the asset, you get this realized gain, and is that a useful indicator of the performance of the business? Surely this is the underlying fair value change that matters. And the last one is, well, we also seem to be selling assets. And if we're selling assets, and we're going to, and value is all to do with the wealth creation is all to do with the change in value, then why aren't we showing that change in value in the income statement? So I look at all these things and I think, well, fair value P&L is the right answer for each of these scenarios. I don't see why these situations suddenly mean we've got to show this realized gain in the income statement.
I wonder if I could just back that up a little bit, Stephen. At an insurance roundtable on Friday, we were discussing a similar problem where the things are going to be recycled out of OCI to P&L, and one of the analysts there said, oh, we just backed that number out. So, you know, how's it giving useful information?
Where you go?
Two comments. The first one is, I'm not expect the sale meaning activity. And our view is important. And whether you accept it or not, when I go out, and as I understand, most people say, you know, it is a very, very big decision. Of course, in some circumstances, maybe company will pick and choose. But it will have a significant consequence in terms of the tax. You sell, you don't have future holding gain and loss. And dividends, and that. And secondly, this is my key point, Ian, your point, or maybe this point, horrifying me. Why we have the debate on the conceptual framework of OCI? So we concentrate so much on breaking items, which we believe it is so important. Now we say it.
I'm not sure this is a breaking item.
Well, I mean, it is a bridging item. Yeah. But just because I conceptually can see that we might have bridging items in two different measurements doesn't mean that I have to agree to this one being a bridging item.
But qualify me, you see. We try so hard to try to convince people that these are the few items we feel must be in. And now, at standard level, we say, we may not have it.
Well, that horrified me that Ian was supposed to completely wrong the first time.
Yeah, I'll change.
People have mentioned window dressing profit and loss through realization of the fair value changes that are in OCI. And so that sort of triggered in my mind a question about whether there's going to be some sort of chaining notion for the OCI category. We talked a lot about that in the amortized cost category and whether there was or not. And we said that, well, you could have sales in the amortized cost as long as they weren't, as long as they were insignificant and infrequent. And so would it, if you have, let's say you have things in the OCI category and you have them there because you said you're using them to manage interest rate risk, and interest rates haven't changed, but you've had a lot of sales. Is that an indication that they have been frequent and they are significant? They shouldn't have been in OCI, they should have been in fair value, you know?
I think, and I answered this before, I think that we're not planning to have a check on the sort of level of selling activity in fair value OCI so much as amortized costs or held to collect. And for me, that's because you get such a relatively limited set of information on the held to collect category that I think we need to be more careful to watch for the amount of realization through sales in that category. But as long, I think what it might do is make you check whether you really think your objective is what you said it was and whether you have or haven't moved, for example, rather than a fair value OCI model. But I don't think it's monitoring sales per se. It's really, is the business really model really as you described it more generally, if I can put it that way.
Daryl?
For me, there is a very clear middle category that exists here. We can talk about the accounting in a second, but very clearly situations where you are holding to collect and sales really are incidental. It's very clear that there are genuine trading environments where you have a continuous flow back and forth of. So it feels to me like there is a definite case to be made for the fact that there is a middle category that exists between those two extremes. From an accounting perspective, I think the point about the realizations that go through the income statement is that that happens equally with amortized cost category. That from time to time you will have realizations, and those realizations will appear in the profit and loss. And right now you have no other information. You don't necessarily have the fair value sitting anywhere. The advantage of the middle category is that we're giving you the two pieces of information. The income statement, which tells you about what has actually happened in terms of flows, and shows the fact that the flows of income occur over the life, generally speaking, in the transaction. And the balance sheet, which tells you what might happen and what activity or what action the management might take. So I still see the benefit of the middle category, because I clearly, for me, it's very clear that there is a third potential business model that exists. Also, though, I just reacted to Jan's comment, which I thought was quite important. I think I've also heard from a lot of people that fair value, profit and loss in the insurance space does make sense. But I've yet to go into a meeting where people haven't said there are some circumstances where fair value OCI makes more sense. So I'm not sure, and we're not yet to discuss insurance, but I'm not sure that discussion is going to be yet.
Could I just respond on the accounting? Sorry. I agree with you, there's good information. My point is, I don't see the point of accumulating the fair value movement up in OCI and then moving them down. I might show them separately, directly in profit and loss. That would still give you your fair value information on the balance sheet and would still separate your two functions in the middle category.
Does that account equally for amortized costs then?
Because amortized costs
we don't take account of the fair value at all.
You're effectively accumulating the fair value in that circumstance off balance sheet,
yes,
until such time as you decide to realize it. Now, it seems to me accumulating it on balance sheet is giving you more information.
But the major argument, I'm not fully with the amortized cost argument either, but the major argument, as I understand it for it, is that you're going to trade it out. It's not going to be a movement in value at the end. If you hold it to maturity, you buy it at this cost, you collect all your cash flows each year, and then you just get it back at the same amount that you paid for it. So the argument there is putting fair value movements in either OCI or profit and loss is a bit misleading because your business model is something quite different. But you can't argue that for the middle category.
Ian, there's some merit in what Patricia said in this, I think, is that for many of the assets that are held in fair value OCI portfolios, that's also the circumstance. They're also going to be held until such time as they realize at the end. For some of the assets, they might be sold, and that's because we failed the first test at the amortized cost level, that we might sell to rebalance the portfolio, or we might sell for credit, concentration. So in other words, there's some circumstances in which you might sell, but this is not a category that is meant to capture circumstances where you regularly sell. And therefore, to prepare an income statement on the basis that it appears that you are always going to realize through sale doesn't seem appropriate either.
So if you sell 25%?
25% of the portfolio.
I guess this is why, to an extent when Patricia said that, I think it's possibly valid. But is there a point in time at which there is too much selling in fair value OCI, and you say it actually should be fair value profit and loss? I'm not sure we've talked or thought about that too much, but there may well be a point at which we believe you have failed that little category. And perhaps that is something we should do.
Which brings me to a point I've forgotten, that's complexity. The other reason I'm opposed. Trying to determine, which are in the first category, which are in the second, and which are in the third, really quite hard.
Yeah, and look, I would agree, but if I take things like a liquidity portfolio, for example, for me, there's a clear case that the liquidity portfolio belongs in the central category. There's selling activity going on. The primary purpose is holding for collect, so it's not the one category and it's not the other. That means to me there's a clear case for saying that the economics are best represented by that little category. Sometimes complexity makes sense. It represents what's actually happening.
I was going to second the recommendation by the FASB board members to come up with a very crisp, clear definition of a business model for fair value OCI. I think that is critical. I think what you have here in paragraph 73 is the start of that. For me, the business model is not about fair value changes. It's about realizing value and the way I'm managing assets to realize value. And in the context of an asset, a standard dealing with assets, I think it's probably appropriate to focus on the way you're managing the assets to achieve that maximization or optimization of value. But that can also include the way you're also managing your liabilities, as you say in 73D3. So from my standpoint, it's about, as I said, realizing value, which I know is contradictory to what I think Stephen is saying, but this is not, the business model itself is not about communicating fair value changes. That's an indication, if you will, of how you're going to realize value. But that's not the business model, fair value changes. So I think if you spend the time to actually articulate that, and it goes back to the conversation we were having around paper 6A, I think the points that Tom Linsmeyer raised were spot on in terms of describing not only activities, what you're trying to achieve in terms of managing these assets, but also the value realization concept. And I think if you pull that together, you've more or less got your business model for fair value OCI. I'd like to also just observe, Ian, I think the reason why analysts today ignore the so-called movement in fair value OCI is because there's not a symmetrical model. It's one-sided, so they feel they need to pull that information out to get the quote-unquote symmetry across cost. And I think, frankly, you know, during the crisis, many analysts actually placed a lot of weight on those unrealized changes because they felt they were actually going to be permanent or other than temporary, and it was going to impact the financial flexibility of those financial institutions. So, you know, on a general basis, yeah, they say they pull it out. Let me tell you, in times of extremis, they're not pulling it out. They're weighing that pretty heavily on the financial flexibility of these entities.
Philippe? I can leave with the proposal not to try to define precisely the Charleroi P&L business model. And say it's already doable, don't try to define it. But I think it just increases the need to have a precise definition of the Charleroi OCI model. And in comparison to the amortized cost model, we try to define it by giving guidance on what is acceptable activities and what is considered activities that go against the business model. In comparison here, if I recall correctly, paragraph 73, we try to define what are those acceptable activities under the Charleroi OCI, but we don't give any indication about activities that are inconsistent with that model. And 71, say, we don't try to give a threshold on how much sales are consistent or inconsistent with the business model of WCI. But still, without trying to give a bright line, is not there a way of behaving with a portfolio of instruments that clearly is inconsistent with WCI, like a very active saving activity? Why don't we, the same goes with that. Patrick mentioned it. Why don't we say that if you're really actively selling, it's usually inconsistent with the business model of WCI?
Okay. One of the things I think Daryl pointed it out is at what point do you flip out of the value of WCI into.
Let's accept there is no right line, but I think qualitatively speaking, a certain behavior would be seen as inconsistent. It's called trading. We don't want to define it, but you can see it's trading. You can see it.
Our baseline that is difficult.
Thank you. The education system, I just want to come back to the Ian's proposal.
Let me confirm.
You are saying, sorry, but then we just decide on the three buckets last month or two
months?
Yeah. Okay. Just quickly come back. So you were just suggesting to come back to the original IFRS 9. And you are not really suggesting that we should measure just fair value through PL. Everything fair value through PL. Just one more.
That's
what you are real intention or not. Because a little sounds to me very contradictory. Because as Uego said, question is whether or not we should provide more information or not. And we are now discussing what is the situation when we need to provide more information.
I don't think my proposal would provide less information, but in a different way.
Different way? Different information.
For what?
But to keep the amortized cost more.
I think the video thing is getting cut out.
So he said keep what we have in line.
Yeah. Right. That means, less information.
Clearer information.
Okay, we're running out of broadcast time.
I've got it very quickly. We don't have to answer now. If we order now to introduce rules around this middle class that we have to define, but we don't know how to define it. One day I would like to understand, if we left what we have in 39, instead of doing all of this, how much of a difference would it be? Could we live with that instead and get more or less the same outcome?
Well, with this cliffhanger, all right, thank you very much. Have a nice day of Norwalk, and
okay.
We'll see you tomorrow.
We'll see you tomorrow.